All right. It is Friday, December 27th. We're sitting in Alexandria, Kentucky on a sunny day, a beautiful day, talking with Hall of Fame member and radio legend Gary Burbank. Hey, Gary, how you doing?
Thank you, Jack. Doing fine.
It's great to see you again after all these years. It's been a while since we've seen each other, really.
Have you noticed I'm shorter now even than I was before you? my feet are getting bigger.
Oh, man, you are.
I'm shrinking. I'm turning into a puddle.
You are well loved in Louisville radio, as you are, and we'll talk about Cincinnati and other places you've been to. But this is for the University of Louisville archives, and so we want to get as much on here as we can. Let's talk about you first. Now, you're not, I know you have a lot of Louisville connections. Your wife, Carol, is from there, and you got a lot of ties there, but you're not from Louisville originally.
No, I'm not. However, if I think of hometown, I kind of think Louisville always. I guess because that was the first good radio station that I worked, and that was Wacky.
Wacky Radio. We'll talk about that.
And just being a Card fan, and I have to be one because my wife, Carol, will not stand for anything else, and it's been that way all these years. No, I've always been a Louisville just has a very special place for me.
Well,
I don't know if it's a topography of the people or maybe a combination of the two.
When you were a kid growing up in Memphis or wherever, did you always want to be a disc jockey or on the radio, or you were a musician?
I was a musician in Memphis. I played with a lot of, you know, Bill Black Combo,
Ace
Cannon.
That was a hot spot for all that.
Yeah. And I was with the Marquise for a while. Oh, I was the second drummer with them. But I did think radio. In fact, I played on a session at Stax Records. One thing that got me back thinking about radio, I was content to be a musician for a while, and I was paid $52 for a session, and I got the check maybe 2-3 months after I did the session. The day I got the check, the great guitarist Charlie Freeman, and most musicians, you know, from that era of Muscle Shoals and all that I'm talking about, Charlie called me from jail said, "Hey, man, can you come get me out?" I said, "How much?" He goes, $52. I said, "Isn't that a coincidence? I just got my check for the session knowing I'd never see it again." and so I thought to myself, you know, somebody's making some money off these records, and it's not the drummer.
Yeah.
So then I thought the old radio school thing. I said, you know, I'm going to try that. And I went to Keegan's Technical Institute.
In Memphis?
In Memphis, yeah.
Now, this was in the what, middle 50s, late 50s, early 60s?
It was, I'll tell you, my first inkling of radio was getting out of high school in the 10th grade. Being asked, I joined the Army.
I'm sure there's a story there.
Well, there's one. Yeah, I joined the Army, and I told them I would have been in radio before. I joined the Army, and I said, that guy said, "What do you want to do in the Army?" I said, "I like to be with Armed Forces Network." I'm 17 years old, but I knew about that. And I said, "Maybe you become a disc jockey." He said, "Oh, well, that's great. Here, sign right here where it says Regular Army." And I did, and I'm thinking I'm on the way, and so I. They take me to Fort Jackson, South Carolina in Columbia. So we get on the bus in Columbia, and we go to Fort Jackson, pull up, and they had been so nice, so very, very nice to all of us. There was about 8 or 9 of us on the bus. I was the very last one in the back. And as they stop at the base, this sergeant gets on screaming and yelling, "You low-life maggots, this is what we have now, Mike." And he starts bodily throwing people off. And I'm thinking, boy, I'm glad I'm not with those guys. And he threw them. I mean, and he finally, I'm the last guy, and he sees me and he comes back and he says, "What's your story?" I said, "This isn't my stop. I'm a disc jockey." And this sergeant just started laughing. All the other sergeants started laughing. But they had me up till 3 o'clock in the morning with a rake making radio waves underneath barracks. So I learned my lesson. I kept my mouth shut. That was my first experience in radio.
Almost.
Yeah. And then later on, of course, as I said, I went to Keegan's, graduated. They sent me to KLPL in Lake Providence, Louisiana. I immediately remember I had been a musician, so I wasn't accustomed to getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I was accustomed to going to bed at 5 o'clock in the morning. And my very first day on the air, after I'd done a shift over the weekend to learn how to do the board and all that, my very first day on the air, I think it was Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs that I played. And I'll just use that. I did the newscast like you do.
Sure, yeah.
Little bitty market, daytime station. Mm-hmm. And when the news was over, I hit the record, immediately sat back and went to sleep. I slept for 45 minutes.
And the record's going.
Woke up, shook, shook, shook. And I woke up and this is it. I'm going to be fired my first day. And so what do I do? So I just turned the microphone on and said, that was Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. And I went on and nobody ever said a word.
Oh,
and I thought, there's no one listening to this radio station. But that gave me a lot of confidence because I knew I could do no wrong that early in the morning. I was doing characters early in the morning. And
so you started doing characters back then?
Never done before. That.
Right,
I was just looking for something to do to interest myself so I would go to sleep. So it kind of caught.
And those characters continue throughout your career?
Not really. Just
starting, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we went from there to where?
It was in West Monroe, Louisiana, KUZN, Cousin Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there for about a year or two, then moved to WWUN in Jackson. That was my first top 40 station where I was a top 40 jock. Put a little slidey glide, dippity hip, bumping you up, bless my right on rock and roll soul, light my candle, make me hard to handle. One of those.
And you loved it.
Oh, yeah. I was. My name then was Johnny Apollo, your blue-eyed soul brother
really?
In the front row. Putting a wiggle in your walk and a giggle in your talk. And so I did that, and then I went to Memphis and worked at WDIA.
Oh,
I was the first. I was the first white guy to work, white person to work on the second floor as a disc jockey.
Hmm.
And then I left there, went back to Jackson, then back to Memphis. I had a job at WMPS in Memphis. And what are you laughing at?
Nothing.
Okay.
Carol, you want to add anything to that?
am I not right?
What? Well,
okay.
We missed something there.
I've got a studio audience here. But I went back to Memphis and worked for Plow. And at Plow, most people who've worked for Plow Incorporated have the same opinion of them that I do. And it was this, that I'd get off the air in the morning, and then I'd go, I had to stay for 2 hours in case they needed me in the production room. And I would just sit there and... They called me in the manager's office and said, you can't sit in the lobby. We don't want anyone to know we have any disc jockeys. I don't know what it was. I'll go sit in the production room. So I went in the production room and I kept my mouth shut, but they said, well, you're distracting him. Okay. And so I ended up for like 3 months every day getting off the air, sitting in the bathroom. And if a salesperson came in and squatted next to me, I would yell, do I come in your office and do that? And I was a disruptive force, and I hated it, and I got an offer at WAKY in Louisville, and I went there, fell in love with the city.
Oh, it was a great place.
And great radio station.
That was what year was that? That was
68.
You had some great people there. You were
Duke of Louisville,
yeah.
Bill
was
Bailey.
Was Johnny Randolph the PD?
Randolph wasn't the PD. It was Bob Todd.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Dude Walker was over there. Some great
legends,
jocks.
Yeah,
yeah,
legends,
guys that, they went on and did some really good things.
Was Coyote there? Was
Coyote was not there yet.
Nothing.
Yeah, although we were best of friends.
Yeah.
Now. But he wasn't there in those days.
Huh. And what were you doing, mornings, afternoons? You did
afternoons? I went in to do afternoons.
Yeah.
I did afternoons, which I liked better because I was a little frenetic and my humor on the air probably worked a little better in the afternoon than it did in the morning. However, I left there to go to, after 4.5 years, I figured I needed to go out and branch out a little bit if I was going to get, where I wanted to be in radio.
What did you envision that to be at that time?
I just envisioned, making more money, getting to a bigger market like we all did in radio. And
ambitions for New York or LA or Chicago?
I had all those ambitions.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. I went to New Orleans. I was there for almost a year.
That's after you left Wacky?
After I left Wacky at WNOE. And then I got a call from CKLW, which was maybe the biggest station in the country because the signal was amazing there. It was you could talk into the microphone, you could say, "Hello." And it would come out, CKLW. And you're, whoa. Yeah. And it was, I got a telephone call after being there for about a year to show you how big it was, from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And they said, "We'd like to do a story on you." And I said, "Why? I'm in Detroit." They said, "You guys are number two in morning drive in Cleveland."
Oh, my God.
Really?
Gosh. Wow.
And that intimidates you. But it was a great radio station, and I was there for a while until Carol and I both decided. And I won an award as Major Market Air Personality of the Year. I was up against Don Imus, Robert W. Morgan. And I thought to myself, now, middly, glory-wise in radio, in my brain, my little disc jockey brain, I thought, that's enough, you know. Where do I want to be?
So you didn't think New York or L.A.?
After
or
that, no, because this station was as good as any of those, you know.
Yeah.
And made great friends, and we still hang together to this day. And but still, you know, when Carol was ready to go back home, I was ready to go back home.
So with all this, that's when WHAS came in the picture.
And
how
when,
did that happen? And that must have been a surprise to you.
Well, that was when Jeff had,
Jeff
had died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they were looking for someone, and
who contacted you? Was it Hugh Barr? Was Hugh?
Hugh Barr.
Yeah,
Hugh Barr. In fact, I contacted them.
Oh, did you really?
I did. I knew, you know, they'd be looking for someone, and I knew we wanted to come back home. And
What was your opinion of WHAS at that time?
Because I thought it was pretty stoic.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I didn't know if I would fit in.
Yeah.
But I knew that I wanted to go back to Louisville. And
Wacky
I thought,
wasn't in the picture?
Yeah, Wacky was not. You know, I'd been there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'd done that kind of thing. I thought I could do better things at WHAS.
More of an adult format.
Even though they had all that reverb.
Yeah.
And I was so happy when I first went on the air and realized the reverb button was right there on the board.
Yeah.
I could turn it off.
So Hugh Barr contacted you.
I said, how about sending me a tape? And I'm thinking, okay, you know, and that puts you in your place. It's okay. I'm fine with it. You know, thinking, I guess I should send a tape. You know, I want to say, I was, you know, Don Imus. And you're pretty lucky. But in my little pea brain, I'm thinking that. But, you know, of course I understood. And so I sent him a tape. Yes, you got the job. Come on down. I did.
Carol, how long a period was this going on? This was probably about 1974, somewhere along there.
It was.
Yeah,
I think
74, 73 or 74.
75?
It was more like 76.
76, yeah.
Because we moved to Detroit in 74. And
is that right?
Yeah, we were in Detroit in 74. So,
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 76.
So, 76, yeah. So,
because I was there. I didn't leave till 76, the first time. I was there and then left and came back. So
you left, I think.
Right after you came.
Right after I got there.
In July. You got there earlier.
Yeah.
Now, do you remember walking into the station? What was your impression? Because it had this was the thing that was owned by the Binghams. They had the radio, the newspaper down the street, and radio and television in the same place, and this building with a fountain in the middle and everything.
You know, and I had been, you know, a rockin' DJ, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And walking into this very conservative place, I don't mean politically, I mean socially conservative place. I had hair down to my butt just about, you know.
I want to tell you a story. I don't know if you remember this or not.
No.
But now, Wayne Perkey was on the air the mornings. Jerry David Malloy was on, and I was on. They were going to fill the afternoon. Now, up to this point, we had been very stoic, but Hugh Barr was trying to make us into the cuddly giant, you know, getting us out.
Yeah.
And so by this time, we're all wearing jeans instead of coats and ties.
Right.
And we've got little beads around our neck and open collar shirts.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew you were coming. And so you'd been upstairs for an interview, and we're down in the announcer's lounge waiting for you to come down and meet us. I'll always remember you stepping off the elevator in a three-piece suit with a vest and hair down to here.
Yeah.
And you walked in and saw us and said, "Something's wrong with this picture."
Yeah, you're right. I do remember that now. But if you, the suit was plaid.
Yeah, it was. It was.
You're right. I remember that suit. But.
Huh? Probably the last time.
Yeah, probably so. Probably. Yeah, you didn't need it.
I never needed it again. No, I do remember you guys surprising me like that.
Well, we were.
And I expected everyone to wear suit and ties. However, Bill Britton didn't have on.
Oh, no. That's right. Yeah.
And that was one of my favorite things when I came in there. I had my own announcer.
That was a crossover period, still a crossover period.
You know, where they had announcers come in. And on the hour and on the half hour, Bill Britton, who I loved. I mean, I was the nicest man in the world, and I had so much respect for him. And you talk about round, pear-shaped tones.
Oh, yeah, he had it, didn't he?
He came in, and this is WHAS, Louisville. And I'd be going, whoa, yeah, that's what I want to sound like. You know, and so, right off, my biggest problem was I hated Cuddly Giant.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I mean, I just didn't like. Right. But you know, I've always been very docile in radio. You can ask any program director I've had, I will follow the format to a degree. You know, but if it gets in the way, if it gets in the way of something good, I'm not gonna mess with. You know, I'm gonna take that. But I always had that liberty. Usually, every station that I would be hired, I'd let them know. You know, if you want me to do what you're hiring me for, you've got to stay away from me. At CKLW, the very first morning, that's back when I was crazy, very first morning on the air, Bill Hennis called me, hotlined me to tell me something that I broke in the format. I yanked the phone out of the wall so he couldn't call me again. And you know what? He never did. And instead of him jumping me, I jumped him. I said, how do you expect me? I mean, when you see someone on TV doing a variety show or any kind of a show, do you have somebody in behind the curtain yelling at him all the time?
Right.
Wait till he's done. And he always says to this day, he said, you were exactly right, and I never did that to another guy.
How about that? Well, you taught him a lesson.
Yeah.
Well, you want to get back to Louisville. Carol is from Louisville, and so that helped establish some roots again and all that stuff.
And I had so many friends in Louisville.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, when I got to Louisville, one of the first things I did was get Bob Moody from CKLW a job at Wacky.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so,
what were your expectations going into WHAS? What did
you know? It was. I wanted to go to WHAS, and I wanted to stay there the rest of my career. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be there for you know.
It was home for one thing.
I was home. I think I could have made enough money to live very, very comfortably, but I couldn't at Wacky.
Yeah,
you see what I'm saying? I was in a better position to I think sell myself.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was important to you at this time in your career.
It was. And I kept getting, and I'll tell you something else. I used to get, when I was working at Wacky or even New Orleans, big fish, little pond. And I never liked that. One reason I went to CKLW, let me go to the big pond.
Yeah.
Because I heard you. Yeah. I heard Jerry David Malloy. I heard you guys and how good you sounded, and I heard these other guys too. I knew you guys could go anywhere you wanted to go, but the guys in those markets tended to think they were a little better than us. Mm. Well, I went up there, kicked their butts, and then came back home.
That's good. I'm glad you did. Well, now, Hugh Barr must have left not too long after that. Did he?
Maybe. I was really like that man. I thought. He was a very, very good program director. He seemed to be putting things together great. He was the kind of person you wanted to work for.
He could put the pieces together and let the pieces do their thing.
Yes, he did. And he never, that's what I think, that's when I really came of age, really, because Hugh Barr didn't bother me. He, you know, if I did something really funny, he'd let me know. If I did something stupid, he didn't say a word
because
he knows right. I knew it was stupid.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I mean, he directed me, but in a good way. Jerry David was the same way. Yeah. I think Jerry David was the program director.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And Jerry David was exactly the same way, and would come in just shaking his head, laughing about something, and Johnny Randolph at Wacky always said, "I know how to handle you," and he said, "You have like a puppy ego." He said, "You come in the back, you'll do something, on the air, and you come in the back, you'll be looking at me, and if I say, that was really good, and you run back in and try to do something, better, And so it was just a wonderful situation for me working at WHAS.
Well, now the characters that we'll talk about your characters. I want you to run through some of the characters.
Sure.
Were any of those invented there, or had you had most of those throughout the years?
No, most characters come from just the opportunity. If something is happening in the news, and I'm not really an impressionist, but I could come close some people. I'll give you a good example of how a character comes to life. There was a lady named Fern Stone who lived in Paris, Kentucky, and she used to call me every couple of days, and she is so funny. She was a big shot in the Democratic Party, and she'd call me and crack on things, and I'd put her on the air every now and then, And one day, her and a friend called me, and her friend was on the extension, and they were talking at the same time, saying the same words.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got the biggest kick out of it, and they'd both been into the gin, quite obviously. And the next day, I put together these two characters called Eunice and Bernice. The Siamese twins joined together at the telephone.
Mr. Metz?
Mr. Metz! And what that is really one voice, and the other voice is a harmony. It's the second above the first voice, right? And so I would do the harmony part. I'd do the regular voice part, then do the harmony part second. And then I'd play it back and talk to myself as them live on the air.
How long did it take you?
Well, let me tell you the end of this. This is so funny. And then right after I did it, I got, you know, I go to news or whatever, phone rings, you know, I'm always working on this phone. Hello? You think I don't know what you're doing? I said, oh, God, it's Fern. I said, are you upset? She goes, no, I thought it was funnier than hell. And she was great. So that's kind of how a character would come up with
me. Well, one thing I always appreciate you, but Gary, you always, you could let other people, you got humor from other people too, and you'd appreciate it other people.
Sure.
You could incorporate them and let them be funny too. That was great. And
then
recognize
and
that.
And then I had, but there were many people, you know, in the station that, you know, would come in, you know, and help me out with stuff and do voices with me if I needed an extra
remember
voice.
Remember who was helping you with any of that? Do you remember any of the
people? Claude Fulkerson,
oh, yeah,
Claude Lane, you know, used to work with me some. Mm-hmm. I know that he wanted to go out to L.A., and he went out to L.A. and was working with Rick Dees. I got him in, I think, with that, or at least my name did, and he said, Dees was a tyrant, and he said, I said, well, you know, what happened? He said, well, I had to leave because I said to him one time when he was throwing a fit, I said, Cary Burbank never acted like this toward me.
You're out of here.
And Claude's still around. He still does great. He does great voices and things.
He does.
Yeah.
He's good, yeah.
So I'm trying to remember exactly about, you know, how these things came up. And they were just all, it was all opportunistic. Anything, you know.
You've done that your whole career.
Yeah.
In Cincinnati. We'll talk more about that in a minute.
You react, you know, to what's going on.
How long would it take you to produce something like a Eunice and Bernice or any of those characters?
It had to be fast, and that was my problem. I think when I left there was a hole in the wall. But I had more than one hole in the wall. When I get mad about, you know, I couldn't think of a punchline. One was caused by my head, you know, slamming my head into a flick, crack, because it was
so immediate.
This I had to get that done by the time I went on the air.
Did you go into the studio to begin to do that? Did you stuff for the next day or the next day?
Oh, 10 o'clock in the morning. If I was working at 2 in the afternoon, 10 was not even really enough time. I should have been there at 6. Trying to do all I, you know, and you know, if I'd had a producer at the time, I'd have been much better off.
Well, you were great working with people like Van Vance. You were
Van Vance School of Dance, High Finance, Burt Lance, Van Vance School of Dance.
He still goes by that. Everybody still calls him Van Vance, VV, and the School of Dance.
And the School of Dance, yeah. And Van and I were just good friends, and it was easy on the air with him, you know. Yeah. And Paul and everybody else. I don't, you know, Glenn Bastian.
Milton Metz.
El Mezzo was one of my favorite people of all time. Still is. Yeah. And I used to call him the master broadcaster. and I meant that sincerely.
Let's see. I'm trying to think of the other characters. Reverend Deuteronomy Skaggs.
Reverend Deuteronomy Skaggs.
How'd
came
that come
up
about?
That came about actually in West Monroe, Louisiana. That was one I brought in with me. I used to... You know, if you've been in small markets,
and you know
how they bring the preachers in on Saturday and Sunday. I had one coming in, and the manager told me, he said, make sure you get the money. It was $1 a minute. Make sure you get his money because he didn't pay us last week before he goes on the air. I said, okay. And so I saw him. I said, you got to give me $30 before you go on the air. Okay. And then you got to give me $30 for today. Okay, so he goes to his, all our preachers had mailboxes, and he goes and gets his love offerings, and he tore into it, and it's cash. and so he puts $60 together. Here you go. So I took the money, and he's on the air, and he's talking how you'd feel that purple radius. He was one of these guys like this, and I always was amazed by him. And my name was Johnny Apollo at the time, and he was about 25 minutes past the hour, and it didn't sound like he was wrapping anything up. And what we did, if they went long or short, we made it up with music, whatever. It was no big deal. And so It's 28 after. He's still not wrapping it up. And it's 29 after. He's got a minute to go. But, you know, he paid for 30 minutes. And if he goes longer, it's going to cost him more. And he's preaching, and God came into the building. Johnny, you give me another minute, and I'll give you another dollar. And I said, that's a character. That's, you know? That's, and so I started doing the Reverend Deuteronomy Skaggs, which I just made the name up, of the Little Radio Church of the White Winged Gospel Truth.
Yeah, yeah.
And which reminded me of all those guys. And I've been doing him. I did him the whole time. Oh, yeah. And don't make me holler. Don't make me shout. Turn them pockets inside out. I'm talking that green salad of salvation. Because that's what the guy was all about. And, you know, the funny thing is, almost any preacher I ran into, that would be their favorite character that I did.
Yeah,
They like, and it used to worry me that they might think it was sacrilegious, but it was not. It was, to me, I was just doing my typical little satirical look at this charlatan.
Well, I shared before we started the recorder about one of my favorite stories you did with him about Oral Roberts.
Mm.
And Oral had said that if the Lord didn't send, if you didn't send so much money, the Lord was going to call him home. And you had Deuteronomy say, you'll kill two birds with one stone and get rid of Oral, and I promise you won't hear from me again.
You won't hear from me again.
That was a great one. I remember you had a truck driver? I mean, Porky Chadwick was, remember?
Porky Chadwick was actually a disc jockey in Pittsburgh.
Disc jockey in Pittsburgh.
And I was doing that voice, you know, and but he became, later he became, when I moved here, he became I period, B period, Ludlow period, Bromley period, period, and his brother Eugene. And that was just, you know, it was just a voice, you know, just, I don't know. It was, I guess everybody said, you know, what people asked me, you know, now that was a black guy, you know, how do you get away with that? And I said, I don't do color, I just do voices, you know. And Trumpy said, that's a cop out. I said, well, it worked.
Let's see, who else? I was thinking of, we had Captain Gorgeous for a while.
Captain Gorgeous was just a gay character, you know.
Yeah, I had Captain Gorgeous.
Now, that was back in my formidable, I was working up to doing good satire.
Now, did you do Gilbert Gnarly? You did Gilbert Gnarly.
No, I never did Gilbert Gnarly
you did
there.
In Cincinnati, okay.
Yeah, I did that here. I was, in fact, that came up, that's a character that that came up when I was doing, I saw the back of a magazine, What Kind of Man Drinks Dewar's Scotch? And I was doing a play on our morning guy, and I had to do something because the week before I had called the FCC to complain on the air, to complain about our morning guy calling people and putting them on the air and not telling them they're on the air. And Randy Michaels, who was, you can't do that. I said, you always told me it's better to do it and ask later for permission. And I'm asking now. And he goes, no. So I said, well, I'll do it better. So I called and said I was Jim Scott. But I did the voice of Gilbert Darley, who is more like a... And then I said, this could be a funny, long-running character if he wasn't drunk. And besides, I can't think of his name all of a sudden. Did the great drunk character
Foster Brooks. Yeah, from Louisville.
Yeah, I know his name like I don't mind, but I'm old now, Jack. I can't remember everybody's. If I do Gilbert Gnarly as a different, just kind of confused person, where I would call a place and, you know, call in sick with all these different ailments, and they're trying to tell me I don't work there, and this is the first time I had heard this. I mean, Gilbert Gnarly has been ripped off more than anybody, but I'd call about the you are here at the mall.
Yeah.
How does it look? Because I was, it said I was right. Then I went across the mall. It said I was here again. How did it know? And the people were trying to explain to me. And people would ask me, so how do you get people to stay on the phone?
Yeah, that was a real
one. I would say, it's no trouble at all, because people are basically nice. And here's this confused old guy that, you know, he saw that this machine over here, he thought, you know, it was, you know, the hole was... he didn't know it was his finger he was supposed to stick in that, but it was always clean, you know, sort of, you know. And
did you ever get any feedback from some of that? I mean, obviously people who were upset.
I did. I did get very rarely because people say, and I hate for people to say Gilbert's a crank call because he's not a prank call in the least. Gilbert is not pranking anyone. I mean, I need a straight man. And so I'm calling to find a straight man. Right. You know, and rarely did I ever have to call, you know, twice on a bit. If I was calling, what's the one that everybody talks about? And I can't think of it now. That's my trouble. You were talking earlier about bits, and I'm looking at you like, did I do that?
Right. Yeah. Got a bunch of them.
You do too many, and they just all run together. But what's the one where that everybody talks about, Carol? It's the one everybody, Kentucky Jelly. I called KY Jelly. I love your Kentucky Jelly. And she's going, no. Yes. And I was going on about how wonderful the jelly is. But I do have one slight, it has rather neutral taste on toast. So, of course, when he finds out, well, I entertain the people. I'll give you an example. For a while, Gilbert decided that Ed on 60 Minutes, Ed Bradley, was the smartest man in the world. So he always wanted to call. If he couldn't talk to Ed, he's happy to talk to his secretary because she must be almost as smart as him. And whenever I would call, I could always hear her put the speakerphone on. I know they were gathering around to hear this call from Gilbert. And I'd call for 3-4 months, maybe every week almost, maybe every 2 weeks anyway, and call them numerous times. And she finally one day I called and she said, I know who this is. I'm like, oh, really? And she said, you know, I could sue you. I said, yeah, I suppose. And she said, but you made us laugh and I don't want to sue you. We're just sad that he's not real. I said, well, if it makes you feel any better, I'm getting more like that every day. But it kind of personified the whole thing for me as far as I understood, as long as I didn't hurt, I didn't call and say, I'm going to kick your ass. It wasn't like that. Gilbert called, I cannot deal with this forehead VCR because my neck isn't strong enough. and then they'd have to explain to me why, you know.
I called
Sears. I don't need a hot water heater. No, I need a cold water heater. And so these people get on, let me explain you how this works.
I'd have them
so confused, and I didn't know what I was doing either, so it worked, you know.
So that would just, it would start, and then you'd have an idea, and then it would just flow.
React. I outlined everything I was doing. Oh, okay. I mean, when I got on the air, there was always, I won't call it a script, because no one could read my handwriting, including me. But I'd have an outline of where I was going.
Oh,
yeah.
Really? Oh, yeah.
And so, but normally I'd go off, and if it wasn't going anywhere, I'd come back to the next thing in case I didn't think of something. And so, but I never had a problem with Gilbert or any of the other call outs that I made, because I wasn't playing a practical joke on someone. Yeah, they were on the telephone. They didn't know they were on.
You didn't.
I never told
them.
I never said.
You didn't. No. And you never made them.
I only had
stupid.
One problem one time, and it was Arthur Olson, who used to work at WAKY, who was always a doofus. Pardon me. Arthur called. I called Sprite, and they had this contest. You take the cap off the bottle, and it said, "Please play again." So of course I'm calling, going like. Oh, see, I got a defective cap here. I've 100 times it keeps saying, please play again. And she's trying to explain to me that you got to go buy another one, you know. So I thought it was good. I was going to play it, and I played it on the air. Da, 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 da. Well, I didn't know it was right there in Indiana. And he called them and told them. And so the woman called me and said she was going to call her attorney that she was on the air. And I said, no, wait a minute. You were not on the air. I wasn't? I said, no. I have a lady here that's an actress, an impressionist. She listens to me make the phone calls, and she does a reasonable facsimile of you, and it did probably sound a little like you. Because that's what, and so she did, you know, the other call. That is not your voice, so therefore you have nothing to say to me. Oh, well, okay. Click. I'm lying like a dog.
Bored again.
So I escaped another one.
Well, now, what about... Earl Pitts American. Did that Earl start where did that start?
Now, Earl, I did Earl even, but I didn't call him that. I may have called him Earl at WHAS, in fact, and back as far as, that was one of the first characters I ever did on the radio, but never in the form of a commentary.
Really?
And I started doing him in commentary, you know, here.
Oh, I thought you had done with HAS. You didn't know.
I didn't call him yet. Yeah. Hey, oh. You know what makes me sick about, you know, and he'd call me and it's basically the same thing.
Yeah, but anyway.
And that's another character, you know, you have to be careful with these. I had, back in, let me see, I guess it was early, maybe 2003, I got a letter from an attorney. Guy in Nashville was going to sue me for doing Earl Pitts because that was his character. That's probably about 2006.
Hmm.
And so we said, well, when did you, you know, start doing this? I said, I don't remember ever hearing anybody else do it. And he said, oh, I started this in 1998. So really, so we sent him one of our CDs from 1982.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then his attorney said, well, let's call it Mutual Discovery. I said, my ass, we're going to call it Mutual Discovery. I said, if the guy had called me and said, I do a character kind of like that, we could have worked it out to where I'd never said a word, so man, go for it.
I like that,
I said, but since you hired an attorney and I hired mine, I'm going to use him.
Yeah.
So don't do it again. Cease and desist.
You're good.
I don't know if he did. He probably didn't.
You're still doing some Earl Pitts stuff.
Earl is still, he's been in the longest running syndication, comedy syndication short form in radio ever.
Is that right?
26 years.
Wow. Wow.
And he's, you know what makes me sick? You know what makes me so mad? I'm going to drop my pants, take a butter knife, spread alcohol all over my butt cheeks, super glue my tongue to a fire hydrant, and wait for a pack of wild pit bulls to come along and lick it up. Then he'll go into some diatribe. And it's so, and that's the most misunderstood character that I do.
Really?
Because most people don't get it. Most people think that that's me just doing a redneck and it's that. But Earl is a really, he's a very smart guy. He just got a whacked way of getting to the position that you believe.
Yeah.
And you, when you hear him, the best Earl that's written is if you're driving along in your car and you say, well, he's right. And when you think, wait a minute, I can't agree with this idiot. Yeah. Earl is total satire.
Oh, yeah.
And but it's there's so many people that believe that I really mean this stuff, too. When I first moved to Dunellen, Florida, I played golf with this guy one day that owned this joint. And I went in and had a hamburger. And I was sitting there with a friend of mine having a hamburger. And this lady walked up and she said, J.R. told me you was Earl Pitts. I said, yeah. And she said, well, it's about time someone had the nerve to say the things that you do. And I'm going, yes, ma'am. And before it was over, there's about 7 or 8 people standing around our table, you know, and I'm trying to enjoy my greasy hamburger because I like, you know, and they're all telling me, yeah, and so they all walk off, and I'm like, cool. My buddy goes, welcome to Dunellen. And I said, wow. And then another guy came over and said, by the way, I saw all that going on over there. He said, hey, I get it. And I said, thank you. One guy in Dunellen gets
it.
You know?
That's great. Well, I can't leave Louisville without, and HAS without asking you about snow sharks. People still talk about snow sharks. How did that come about?
You know, I've done a billion bits. I don't know. I never counted, but I've done so many things. That, by a long shot, has been the most, lasted longer.
It was just on Facebook a couple of weeks ago.
See it all the time. Other disc jockeys, you know, have called me and said, I tried to do that and it didn't work. I said, you know why? Because it wasn't me. It was the circumstances. It was right after. When did Jaws come out? Jaws hadn't been out very long. Maybe a year or two, something like that. Maybe that year. And it was the huge snowfall of 78. 78. Mm-hmm. That's where... And we were just socked in. Everyone had cabin fever. I was driving to work one day, and there was a big chunk of ice sticking up out of the snow, and it looked like it had teeth. And I thought, it looks like a snow shark.
And that's where that started.
That's all it was. I got on the air, and I said, I saw a snow shark on the way in. And the phones lit up with people reporting snow sharks.
Isn't that something? Wow.
And I had nothing to do with it. I mean, except just to say snow shark. And it was no stroke of genius on my part, because I just, hey, look at this. And I'd go along with it. Pretty soon, I got pictures of snow shark patrols. What got it going was a Courier Journal. I think about a day or two later, they showed these three thoroughbreds running through a pasture of snow with three fins behind them. And then in another unrelated story, it was a weather story, they had the three weathermen in town, at a, I think it was at a bus stop, and there was a fin behind, and they did this for a month.
I'll be done.
You know, just throwing little fins in everywhere. I think the Courier Journal had more to do with it than I did. I just kind of got it going, and everybody just caught on, and to this very day, when people see me in Louisville, if anybody ever does remember me there, of course, my demographic there, you better be over 50 to remember me. And they'll look at me and say, snow sharks.
Yeah, I go, yes, yeah, snow sharks. I can say Gary Burbank and somebody say snow sharks. Along with everything else, but they really appreciate
it. I did get in trouble over something.
Really?
At that same time. That was also, I think, the winter that people were trying to walk across the Ohio mm-hmm. River.
Yeah.
Because it froze. Mm-hmm. And so I told people on the air that I had tapped into the police lines, and you could hear them talking. I was saying, now you stop doing this. The police are not allowing it. And every now and then you hear it go, I got one. All right, see, so then people actually thought that the police were taking pot shots at people they told not to cross the river, and if they did cross the river, they're going to shoot them and to save their lives.
Oh, gosh.
And then we got, and I think it was, I don't know if Jerry came in, I don't know who, somebody from the news department came in, so we just got a phone call. You got to let people know what you're doing here.
Did you ever have other situations like that where, you know, it was a good idea, but it didn't quite come across?
I had, in fact, most of my situations were good ideas that didn't come across.
I can't imagine.
The ones you heard of, remember the ones that did, but there were thousands of others that just laid there. But, you know, that's just kind of how it works in comedy, I think.
They were owned by the Binghams at that time. Do you have any contact with the Bingham family at all?
No. The only thing, I'd like to say this, since it's in the archives, Barry Bingham Jr. could have owned MTV. It was my idea.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
But I didn't do enough. I got a friend of mine in Detroit that I went doing at CK to send me some video, and I had this idea, and I put this little cheap thing together, like music television. This will work.
Yeah.
And I took it to one of the big executives whose name he was. They say the number two guy in the whole company. And he told me that'll never work. Get out of here. Basically.
Is that so right? Yeah. Wow.
So.
Yeah. Oh, nice. I was only contact. How long were you at HS? You came in 70...
About 5 years, wasn't
it? 76, okay.
76 to... No, 4 years.
4 years.
So both of my stints in Louisville were about 4 years. So that was as long as people could handle me. It was 4 years, you know.
Well, you went on...
Came up here and stayed for a long time.
30 years or so?
30 years almost, yeah.
At WLW.
WLW.
You had a great run there.
And this is close to home, and Carol liked that idea.
Yeah.
When we came here, all intents and purposes I was looking for a place to live. And I understood by that point, I don't have to go to New York.
Yeah.
And I had plenty of opportunity. Hal Smith.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you did.
Come to L.A. or Chicago or something like that. And I thought, no, I want to, you know. And so Cincinnati was close enough. So then I settled here and thought, if I can stay here, I will. And I wasn't sure I was going to, because it wasn't long after I was here, maybe 5 years, 4 or 5 years, that Randy Michaels and J-Core came in, bought the station, took it over.
Mm-hmm. And different atmosphere then.
Yeah, and then you're thinking, well, you know, they're going to come in, they probably want a clean house. So that's when I was really thinking about, and I told my daughter, Tracy, I said, if I could stay, I will. And she said, Dad, I love my friends. I've been to 5 different schools, 5 different years, and I want to stay here if we can. And I thought to myself, if I can do it, I will. And I walked into Randy Michaels' office expecting him to say, well, how much do you want? And I was going to tell him, and he could say, thanks very much. And so I told him, he goes, that's not enough. I said, really? And so he said, yeah, you, I'm going to pay you this. Okay. And I need a 10-year contract. He goes, that's fine. I said, my attorney draws it up. No outs for anybody. If I'm going to say I'm going to stay here for 10 years. And he goes, great, you got it. Wow. I'm like, okay.
So
I knew then
that
I had a home. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
And at the time, it was unheard of. Nobody, yeah. You know.
Well,
gosh,
certainly
man.
Today it's unheard of now.
It really, with Clear Channel and those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
A 5-minute contract is kind of, you know, unless you're willing to pay them.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you developed some characters here, too, that you didn't have in Louisville.
Like, oh, yeah.
Who was the guy with the carpet salesman? What was his name? The short subject?
That was actually a person.
Is that right?
Buddy's carpet. I'm telling you. Oh, you're talking about big, fat, balding guy with a stubby cigar in his mouth and his pants abs. Is it?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
That was actually Hylene George from Lebanon, Kentucky.
Is
remember
that...
Club 68?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was another thing. I started doing this character. Hello there, I'm a big fat balding guy with a stubby cigar in his mouth and his pants half zip, and this time I'm being honest with you when I say. And he would, you know, and he would go on trying to sell something, then we'd have some music, and he'd interrupt the music. Well, it was Hylene all over, and so I get the lawyer copying the blue sheets, and I'm, oh my God, what's this? So they were suing me for... until as I got further into the lawsuit, I saw how ridiculous it was. And finally, I saw the signature, and it was my attorney in Louisville, who was also Hylene's attorney.
So he's
they got me good.
Oh,
and
wow.
I went
pulled
on
a Gilbert and Arley on you.
Yeah, they did. I think it's someone told me once, I used to sell Fuller brushes before I got your radio. And the best salesman is, or the person most apt to buy from you is another salesman. You know, so I bought that from them, hook, line, and sinker. Scared me to death.
Ah, yeah. That's great. I used to enjoy here when you were here, I would listen to your Sports or Consequences every time of that.
You... That was a break. That was just break time.
Yeah.
You know,
but
every
you
day
involved
before,
a lot of people with that.
You know, Bob Trump, Chris Collinsworth, and all of them, they'd all come in there every day. Boomer Esiason was coming in, and a lot of the, you know, athletes and stuff were into it. And
who was your guy, Doc? Who was that?
Dr. Kevin Wolf.
Yeah, and he had a tie to Louisville, I think. I think he had family in Louisville.
Well, I think he had some folks from there. He's from here. When I got here, they had me teamed up with someone else as a producer because that's the first thing I said. I've got to have a producer. Yeah. I can't do all that by myself. And sure enough, I remembered him. He used to send me funny Christmas cards.
Ah.
And I knew he was in radio, and he had been fired the week before at WSAI. I said, you're looking for a job? He goes, yes, you got one.
He
turned out to be the finest comedy writer I've ever known.
Wow.
I mean, he could write circles around me.
You guys did great stuff.
And he also anticipated everything that I needed or did or whatever. And he played the straight man as well as Bud Abbott.
Do you still do anything with him today?
We're still great friends. Yeah. You know, he comes
down.
Do
any work together or anything?
No,
like
we don't
that?
Do any work. He's working in at an ad agency. He's producing and doing commercials and things.
Are you? I know you're doing some things. You have a website with Earl, or are you?
Yeah, pitsoff.com. They just started that. I've had one for a long time.
Are you doing other characters on there? Is it all Earl?
It's got 70 Gilberts on there. I've got about 300 or 400 Gilberts and Earls. I've got 1,000 Earls.
And it's EarlPitts.com, is that what it means?
No, it's PittsOff.com.
PittsOff.com,
and then I've got on Facebook, there's an EarlPitts.American. Mm-hmm. The reason I have to get that straight with you is because I've had so many people take those websites, and I had, it was EarlPitts.com, and the guy wanted $3,000. I called my attorney and said, this guy wants $3,000. He said, oh, you'll win that. Good. How much? He goes, it's going to cost you about $5,000. I said, wait a minute. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, right.
I said, I'm not going to pay anybody squatting on my name that didn't think
right,
it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And so I haven't. You know, but then again, there's a lot of sites out there.
Yeah.
Which kind of hurts us, but I don't care. I'm done. I'm retired now.
You're having a good time. You're playing some music.
Yeah, I'm back to playing music again. I got my dobro out and playing with a guy named Nathan Witt. A lot. Nathan is the mayor of Dunellen. He's a young guy, though. And so he's 40, right?
Just a kid.
He's a child. Yeah, slip of a child. But what I do is I wear clothespins on my face so I look a lot younger. You know, I swear I do. I go, what's he wearing clothespins for? I said, it's just a gimmick. They never asked me why after that.
I don't know if this will make any sense to the people on the archive, but somebody asked me about your Facebook picture today. What's that picture on Facebook you've got? You've got a Facebook picture with a hat on it or something? Is that
I don't know.
No, you don't know? Okay.
Facebook picture.
It's the one that Lynn did. with the probably.
Oh yeah, yeah. My buddy Lynn King is very strange. Photoshop stuff.
Oh yeah, okay.
And so I ended up on Facebook. Someone sent me something that said, "Do you know this person?" And it was somebody that I knew.
Yeah.
And a friend, or you know, deny or whatever. And I said, "Sure." Next thing I know, wham! I got a Facebook page. You know, 2 weeks later, I got 5,000 friends.
Yeah, and
that's because I'm going, sure, I don't care.
Right, yeah, yeah.
What's that name there? You know, see, and I'm thinking, you know, it didn't matter who it was. You know, I just said, I think I have a couple of murderers and people like that. But that's because I was just didn't want to say no.
Well, yeah. I can't end this interview without, if you don't mind, telling the story of why you eventually left WHAS.
Sure.
And how that, I've heard several versions of that. I want to hear your version of how that came about.
My version of it is, and my version is the one that's embellished the most.
Oh, well, let's hear it. I want to hear it.
Greg Hort wrote a book about me up here, and I that was my idea. Call it The Great Embellisher. No, it was a real simple thing. And when it was my fault to a degree, mostly it was. I mean, I was trying to do the kind of radio show that I do now. When I involve one and maybe two or three people. And I couldn't work the phones. I couldn't do all the things that I...
We had to operate the equipment.
Yeah, and everything.
And
operate the board, do the whole thing, get ready for this, get, you know, time that out.
And I should say, even on that day, we had to do a log that you had to physically write in of all the commercials, the times, and everything.
Right, yeah. And so what I would do is I would stack up my cartridges.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had four. Remember, we had four or five cart machines.
Yep.
They were not sequential queue,
I don't think. No, that's right. Oh.
And so, and then I would have to, you know, hit those. And then I'm talking on the phone, doing all that stuff. Well, I would leave them in there for the next break and play one commercial, you know, play them twice.
Yeah.
Because I'm not listening to that. I'm trying to get my show together here. And so, or I would put them all in there, and then I would take them all out and put them over here. And then I didn't run those four, and I thought I did, you know. And so twice they called me in about it, and Bill Campbell said, you know, and so finally I said to him, I said, look, how about getting me a producer? He said, oh, we can't do that. I said, how about if I pay for it? He said, oh, no, we can't do that. I said, well, if I pay for it, what's the problem? He said, well, because Perky will want one.
Perky's
I said,
doing more.
Well, then tell him to pay for it like I'm doing. And he never quite got the concept. And sure enough, and then I messed up again. And so I said, you know, I'm not going to go through this anymore. And that's why I sat in his office and said, you know, I knew this guy. I don't know if he was gunning for me. I don't know why he would have. But I knew that I was never going to get through to him. And this was going to be the way it happened. I'm going to end up in jail, you know, because that's what can happen to you if you falsify a log.
I'm not falsifying
it on purpose. I'm doing it because
I'm
doing my show, which meant everything to me at the time. And so I just said, well, I guess I better go. I thought if I said that, he would say, we'll get you a producer. And he goes, yeah, see you later.
That
was it, basically. You know. I mean, he didn't ask me to stay. He did not look for any kind of solution. But that's his call. He's the manager.
Wow.
And if he felt he could do better without me. In fact, I read in one of the trade magazines that he did a lot better without me, although his ratings went way down.
Right.
I don't know how they figure that, you know. But I'm sure they've got other ways of doing that. I don't dislike the guy. I don't even hardly know the guy, you know. But I never really understood why he didn't try to help me.
Well,
but I would have been there today.
Yeah. Well, Louisville's lost, but Cincinnati's gain, and I'm sure it worked out good for you for everybody here.
Yeah.
It's been a good 30 years for you here. I know.
Well, you have some good people down there too, man. Yeah. But then again, you ended up with the same thing we ended up with, angry white guys on the radio.
Yeah. It's a different atmosphere today.
Yeah, it's a totally, I mean, I learned to ride a motorcycle in the hallway of Wacky. You think I could do that today? We were wacky, crazy DJs having a great time and entertaining people. And, you know, when we went on the air, that was our major task, to entertain people.
Yeah.
And that's what compelled people to listen to radio. And today they're walking around wondering, how can we compel them to listen? Well, let's fire a whole bunch. And I don't think they quite understand the concept that I talked to you about Powell Crossley Jr. understood.
Yeah.
If I'm going to have people listening after he invented this, you know, not Marconi invented the radio, but he downsized it to where you could actually listen to it in the kitchen on the counter.
Yeah, Crosley Radio.
And he built a radio station. And he hired people, you know, like Rosemary Clooney. He hired people that were, you know, Fats Waller, people that would compel people to listen. And then TV came in. So radio again came around and said, okay, what'll we do? Disc jockeys. You know, forget Arthur Godfrey. Yeah. That was great first time, but now it's time to compel, you know, people to listen to the music we're playing. And then when now computers have come in and they just threw their hands up and said, angry white guys. Well, that's only a small portion of the... Now, they do great ratings-wise, and they'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. But you know as well as I do when Rush Limbaugh says, I've got 20 million listeners. When you listen to radio and you... Every 15 minutes, you count as one person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
People who are... I won't say politically wrong or whatever. People who tend to listen to that tend to listen for the entire 3 hours. They count as 12 people. Mm-hmm. Now, you put them in a stadium, they don't look nearly as big as they do on that rating board.
Right, yeah. Big difference, yeah.
And especially with an advertiser the same way.
Well, I don't know if you might share this with me. Before we turn the tape on, you talked about doing an introduction. You were introduced, you were inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Right, into the National Radio Hall of Fame in Chicago, yeah.
And then the last year, they asked you to come up and...
And induct Powell Crosley Jr.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And in doing the research for the speech, I just absolutely... And I'd worked there for all these years. I knew a little about it. I knew he fired Fats Waller. I didn't like that. But Fats had played jazz on... Powell Crosley Jr.'s mother's organ.
Oh, wow.
That's a true story I've told.
That'll get you every time, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was your introduction to...
Basically talking about Powell Crosley Jr. and his son at 21, in 1921, asked Powell Crosley Jr. For a radio. Powell Crosley Jr. said, you don't want a big console in your room like that. Let me build you a radio. He went out and he bought a book, How to Build a Radio, and he bought one. When he got the radio built, it fit on the kitchen counter. And so he thought, well, I've got this now. I need a radio station, WLW. And he hires Rosemary Clooney. And he says to Rosemary Clooney, he said, I'm going to pay you $80 a week, you and your sister. What? How can you possibly do that? He said, at WLW, we spare no expense for talent. I said, at that point in time, the owners of Clear Channel and Cumulus both wanted to have him fired, except they weren't born yet. However, they did love the idea of talent for $80 a week. And that's basically what's happening now, is they can't think of any way to compel people to listen. They got to meet that bottom line, and that's why radio stations are becoming ghost towns.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Not like
yeah.
it was.
Yeah.
On that unhappy note, but then again... We made it through.
Yeah, we made it through and had some great times.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking the time on a sunny afternoon, a couple of days after Christmas, to share this for the ages here.
It's it's just great to see you and Lou again.
Yeah.
It's been way too long.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And, you tend to get stuck in your little place, so I'll be over next weekend.
Right, exactly right. Yeah.
We'll drive you crazy now. Yeah. Carol, you'll pack them up, Carol. We'll bring all the kids, too, the grandkids you saw screaming and yelling as they ran. All girls.
We'll babysit, yeah. Well, enjoy Florida and enjoy golf.
And if you guys ever find yourself in the neighborhood, let me know.
We'll do it.
We'll stay in touch. We'll stay in touch from now. We should do that.
All right, I'm going to shut this off now. There we go.